You know, we live in tumultuous times, and you know that if you're really serious about your money and not having inflation eat it all away, you want to find a safe haven. In that, you need a diversified portfolio, and in that, you got to make a little room for precious metals. And in that, it's nice to have someone you can trust as a precious metals dealer. That is why I deal with Treasure Island Coins at treasureislandcoins.com in Fargo, North Dakota, where their CEO, Chris Olson, is not only a North Dakota congressman, but as well a LCMS Lutheran. You should check him out if you're interested in buying precious metals. treasureislandcoins.com. And while we're in the announcement phase, did you know that I'm leading a tour to Germany in celebration of the 501st anniversary of the Reformation? That's right. You can corner me and ask me why I didn't talk about this or that, or why I should talk about this or that more. Or we can just enjoy the Reformation tour together, along with Bible studies. We'll do some hymn singing on the bus. Yada yada. Good time had by all. You can find out more at wolfmuller.co/reformation501. That's a Lutherland tour hosted by yours truly next June 2018, wolfmuller.co/reformation501. Are you interested in how to live your vocation, life, experience, what to think about the world? Have you found The Resistance? That's my monthly newsletter in which I talk about all that other stuff and a little bit of theology too. Recent episodes have included Bitcoin, movie reviews, the Jabberwocky, and which green supplement I'm currently using. You can find all the free past issues and sign up for the future free issues at bit.ly/2hy1ue1. Yeah, I know that's kind of a horrible thing to use bit.ly, but it's the best way to get you there. bit.ly/2hy1ue1. Or you can follow my Facebook feed or Twitter feed. It'll show up there as well. The Resistance, living life in these evil days, making the best use of the time. Now that all that is out of the way, let's talk Raw and the podcast. Now, what the first thing I don't know is Revelation is coming again. Well, not literally, but yeah, literally, I'm not giving up on Revelation. But, I don't know if you figured this out, the study that goes into every episode of Breakfast Raw is at least 4 hours of reading, plus trying to figure out how to put this into a format, plus then, well, actually recording that. That means it's pretty tough to do on top of a full-time job and everything else that's going on. So, but I want to keep Raw going for a number of reasons. I enjoy doing it. But also, I'm always really glad to hear about those of you who are listening regularly, how much you enjoy getting it. It's an addiction of its own, as it were. And one of the things that I've discovered or that I'm learning through the midst of this is not only do I have a gaping hole in some of my own theology, particularly historical theology, but that the more I dig into what should fill that hole, the more I love it. And that hole is what we might call the intertestamental period, or you could even just say it this way, the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, there's actually a book called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, which is, hold on, I'm going to figure this out here, only 1,000 pages long or so. It's originally published in 3 volumes by a guy named Alfred Edersheim, and it was recommended to me as the best way to learn to understand the history and the culture and the reality that is engaging around the New Testament documents. I mean, I can't believe how much since I started studying the Maccabees, it has informed the way I read the Gospels. And this is the same kind of thing. The more you know the world in which Jesus lived, the more you're going to see the meaning of the phrases that the New Testament is actually using. Phrases like, your brother in the diaspora, or she who is in Babylon greets you, two things that are both in 1 Peter and actually we'll have some reference to today. So along with Revelation Unleashed, which is not going away, it's just going to be a little more plotting if it were possible, and along with the continuing conversation with Pastor Wolf Mueller on eschatology and the end of the world, we're going to start a new series today, and this will probably be sort of the regular series, the one that's most often going to happen because, frankly, it can be put together a little bit faster. What we're going to do is I'm going to spoon-feed you the golden content from this older resource, this 1,000-page book. Now, if you want, you can just forget about Rev Fiskra and go read the book. It's only 1,000 pages. You can do it. in a couple of years, probably. I mean, that's how long it might it's going to take me, I think. You know, just saying. I didn't mean to insult you. If you're insulted, well, fine, whatever. I'm going to spoon feed it to you. I'm going to storify it for you. Storify? Is that a word? I'm going to try to storify it for you. Enshrine it in narrative. Connect it to the texts that maybe need to be brought into bear on it. Going to make it, I don't know if fun is the right word, but the hope is to entertain you a little bit and yet leave you with a better picture of what it really means to be living in the era of Anno Domini. You know, Anno Domini? It's A.D. I know the kids these days, they aren't being taught that, right? You got the before the common era, and then you got the common era. And isn't it just wonderful how clever they are that they've removed Jesus from the center of history by not recognizing that they still center the turning point of history on the birth of Jesus, which is the time that the common era begins, and that the before the common era ends. It's all still about Jesus. We're just not going to mention that it's all still about Jesus. But Anno Domini, I know kids also used to think, back before the common era came around, they used to think it was like before Christ and then after his death, right? Something like that. No, Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord, the year of his birth, Latin. This is beautiful. I wish we talked in Latin more. That's a different topic. But what does it mean to be born in the year of our Lord? What kind of world was inhabited at that point? Who were the powers? How was the culture? What was the thinking? And then all the more so, what did it mean to be a Jew at this time? What did it mean to be an heir of Judea with the bloodline, not necessarily of David, but of his family running through your veins and committed to, in love with, pursuing, seeking, desiring, wanting to purify or retain the religion of David and the religion of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And we certainly do get this in the New Testament. We have pieces of it. But it's almost like they become caricatures, right? Like puppets. You got the Pharisees, they're not fair, you see, they're bad. You got the Sadducees, they're so sad, you see, they're bad too. And you got the Romans, we don't really know much about them, frankly. They're strong, they had swords and stuff. And then you got, you know, Jesus and the apostles, they were really spiritual and pious, right? Now I know you probably don't actually think that, but you know that that's kind of the feel, right? Certainly the way the artwork makes it look these days. And another tangent, we could go all the way down. Been complaining about artwork recently and how little it has to do with the biblical text. Different topic. But what we're going to be doing now, slowly but surely, steadily, and I hope with great value to you personally, is we're going to be developing in our minds a more tangible, a tactile feel for what it means to live in the year of our Lord. As we start this new series, Rev Fisk Raw, AD. It might be too bold to say it this way, but I'm going to say it this way anyway. You cannot understand what it means to be Jesus, what Jesus means for you, a Gentile, unless you're a Jew, what Jesus means for you, a member of the nations of the world, unless you understand what it means to be a Jew. And you cannot understand what it means to be a Jew without understanding the centrality and the power and the influence of the city of Jerusalem. It stands in the middle of everything, as we're going to see as we look at Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost, when in Jerusalem Peter preaches to the middle of the Hebrew world in more ways than one. We'll come back to that idea. It stands as the place to which this people, connected by bloodline, looked not only for their historic identity, but also for their spiritual identity. And this is something right off the bat that as Christians, man, we shouldn't have lost this, but it's almost like we have. This reality that Hebrewism, Judaism of old, at Jesus' time, was as much a history as it was a religion. And it was also a people, yes, a nation too. But it was a history. It wasn't just a set of ideas about morality or who God might be. It was facts about the past in which the God who really is had done certain things to certain people, some Hebrew, some not. Now, this is also what Christianity is. Christianity is as much a history as it is a religion. And in this, it stands apart from the religions of the world in more than one way, but one of those ways is that Jerusalem's important. Now, it's not important in the sense where if you don't go visit Jerusalem, you haven't really understood Christianity. But why would you go visit Jerusalem? You get it wrong if it's because you think there's spiritual power there. It's not because there's more spiritual power there or there's more religiosity there, or that the land itself is somehow holy because of its superpowers. You go to Jerusalem to see where the history happened, to see where the events took place. It is, if we can rightly still call it a holy land, I kind of don't like to do that because of the juju, you know, woo-woo kind of ascribing that we do when we talk that way, the pilgrimages, as if there's earning some deeper understanding. You know, Pastor Wolfman has told us he went there to become a man, right? I mean, that kind of stuff, that's just garbage. But it is a holy land. If you understand holy, not as sanctified in a growing righteousness way, but if you understand holy as a set apart, a distinct, a unique way, it is holy, it is distinct, it is unique because God as a man walked there and died there, was buried there, and rose from the dead there. And to the very end of the universe, that soil, well, testifies of this, remembers this. The dirt itself doesn't have power, no. But the history which happened there, it absolutely does. Now, at the time of Christ, though, right, this wasn't about Jesus. It was about waiting for the Messiah and believing that he would come and sit on the throne there, but it was about Abraham. It was about Isaac. It was about Jacob. It was about David. And I hope that at this point, I mean, at some point, Ra will probably go and play with those stories of those guys. But I hope at this point, if you're listening to this show, that I don't have to tell you who those guys were. I mean, there's only, honestly, there are five, count them as six if you count the marriage. There are five and a half, six, two become one flesh, people, names in the Old Testament that you absolutely need to know their stories, who they are, what they did. Absolutely. As a Christian, you don't have a choice. You need to know who these people are. Adam. And this is the, you know, two that are one, right? Adam and Eve, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David. The rest of it, it ebbs and flows in and out from those things. Oh, did I forget one? I did. You should add Moses to that one. Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. Criticism. Criticize me. Write letters. But you get the point, right? Well, these guys, Moses, it kind of being a tangent, actually, from the real focal point, but it's important, obviously. These guys, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, they all had a very clear covenantal, contractual, promissory reality that was tied directly to that land. And you know, the while Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not settle in Jerusalem, they did wander in the land that would be given to one of their sons. And then, well, David is really the guy who kind of puts his stamp on that fulfillment, and then some. So that in this way, the reign of David, and then Solomon after him, his son, is the fulfillment of everything God has promised from Adam to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, forward. It all does come to pass as at Jerusalem there is placed the Holy of all holies, the set apart of all set aparts, the very presence of the Almighty Everlasting God. I mean, think about what a distinction this is. Any average pagan, anywhere in the world ever, even up to and including today, the New Age mystics and all that kind of garbage, wherever they go, God is with them. Their God, whoever their God is, they can actually, if they're truly classic pagans, they would take their God with them as a statue. Now they just say, look, God's part of the dirt, right? Or whatever. God's part of the air. I have God within me, whatever. They take God with them. For the Hebrew, and this applies to you too, Christian, for the Hebrew and the Christian, it is not so. It's far different. For the Hebrew, if you wanted God you had to go to him. And that meant you had to go to Jerusalem. Now, would God's power be with you if you were in the dispersion far flung to the ends of the earth? Yes, of course. Your God was still with you in that regard. But if you wanted to practice your religion, you couldn't just pray toward Jerusalem. God himself sat upon a box in a building on the top of that mountain with declarations that to receive grace, well, you had to get it from him there. Now, Jesus comes along and he sort of says, look, that is how it was of old. Remember, this is the conversation with the woman at the well in John. He says, that is the way it was. It is right to worship on this mountain. She had the wrong mountain in mind. But yes, there's the mountain in Jerusalem. In the future, it will be spirit and truth. And some idiots take this, excuse me, it's true though, take this and think, oh, therefore it means that there's no more location for God. No. Spirit and truth means where Jesus' words tell us to go, which is not to the building. Well, it is though, right? Tear down this temple and I will rebuild it. So they crucify his body, which supplants and replaces the temple. And he does rebuild it. He brings it back out of the grave. And don't forget what he said on the night he was betrayed and all this was about to take place. He said, take and eat. This is my body. This is the temple. Yeah, this is the temple. The Lord's Supper is still a located reality. Can we as Christians take it anywhere in the world? Yes. But anywhere in the world without the Lord's Supper, you are not as close to God. Yeah. Now, your baptism makes you whole, binds you to Jesus. There's all that too. The Word of God, yes, it all does that work. But don't miss how tactily located your God is in this reality of the real presence of the Lord's Supper. And this distinguishes you from all the religions of the world, which point to God in everything and everywhere, which kind of, again, have you being able to take God with you not as a local thing. I mean, when you walk out of the Lord's Supper, you're taking God with you. He just went down your gullet. It's crazy. But that's not what they're talking about here. That's not what I'm talking about here for the pagan. For the pagan, they're going off and God's in the wind and the waves and all this kind of stuff, right? But for the Jew, they had the same reality that we did. It just was all on this mountain in Jerusalem, where there was this temple that preceded or foreshadowed. It was an image of what was to come in the body of Jesus. But it was this amazing building. And around this amazing building was a pure lineage priesthood, men who served only by virtue of being descended by blood to serve in this place. The whole Korah rebellion, right? Just talked about it a couple weeks ago. That was all based on a guy who wasn't of the priesthood lineage saying, I should be able to do this too. Anybody can approach God whenever they want to. God is free and loves us all. And you know, he was really just saying that out of selfish ambition. He wasn't saying it because he was hoping for mercy, and that's a key thing to hear when you hear someone speak that way, as an aside. No, we cannot just approach God whenever we want. We're sinners. Now, in mercy, does God approach all of us equally in the supper? Absolutely. In baptism? Absolutely. Which is why when you cast those things aside, huh? Yeah. What are you doing? Trying to see God's glory without looking where he is said to look. Now, he said to look for the children of Abraham, which includes the Jews, to this temple, where the priesthood, who are only those descended from Levi and even more narrowly from Aaron, where they offer a particular kind of sacrifice. And they did it all around or next to or moving toward and from this innermost holy of holy places where only the high priest could go once a year. And there, at least before the destruction of the temple by Nebuchadnezzar, there stood this ark. And by the way, ark, this is really important. It's a weird word, right? It only shows up twice in the Bible, once with Noah and once with Moses. And so people think, oh, ark, it means boat. And then what's this other thing Moses says? No, it really is just the word box. Noah didn't build a boat. He built a box. It floated with stuff in it. So it's a boat too. But it probably didn't have a rudder. You know, you always see the pictures. It's like kind of made to look like a modern ship a little bit. It's got the nave and all this kind of stuff. The schematics that we have from Genesis, it's a box. It's a box that God kept afloat by his almighty power. It's not even like it kept itself afloat. God preserves that thing through the flood. That flood destroyed everything, man. And then you have the box that's coated in gold with a lid put on it with the cherubim that God says, put the blood on this box once a year to atone for the sins of the people. And he promises that I'm actually sitting there. And there are times, it seems there's times you don't see this, but there are certainly times, especially when that box is consecrated, that the what they call the Shekinah, it's the glory of the presence of the Lord, a cloud, a dark, fiery, lighty cloud sat there hovering between these statues of the cherubim. So when Isaiah sees his image of the throne of God and the cherubim on either side, and when Ezekiel sees the throne of God and the seraphim moving him around, right? This is all the same reality. And so for the Jew, they didn't just think it was important. They believed that's where God was, and rightly so, because he actually was there. And then outside of that space, there was a golden altar on which incense was always kept burning, always going, in order to represent basically, but literally too, to carry the prayers of the people up into heaven. This is still why we use incense when and if we do as modern Christians. I know Protestants were all anti-everything cool, anti-everything tactile. But the East still does it. Lutherans still do it sometimes. You can find ones who do. Rome still does it. You put a little incense on a little bit of fire, and the smoke just wafts up. I mean, I can compare it to a cigarette kind of floating up, although it smells way better than that, and it's actually way more cloudy than that. And it wafts up, and you see it just kind of rising and floating until it dissipates, until it's gone. You can't see it anymore. Well, see, that's what your prayers do. They come out of your heart, inspired by the Holy Spirit, and they just wander their way up to God, and he finds them all. He holds them all. And that's an ancient, ancient image, going back to the temple itself, the tabernacle itself. And then you also had this seven-branched candlestick, which you remember this from Zechariah's prophecy, right? You got the seven-branched candlestick with the two olive trees feeding it and all this kind of stuff. Well, that was coming out of his vision, was playing on what Moses had put in place, this candlestick. And remember, seven was the number of? It's the number of holiness, the holy light, the perpetual light of God's covenant. You know, we got this kind of weird in Lutheran churches always, almost always, you're going to see this weird hanging cheap light with a red glass around it. We call it the eternal flame. I love this. You know, so I've seen places where it's electric, like they plug it in, so it's always lit. Oh, that's a good way around the symbol. At my first parish in New Jersey, I don't know if it was to save money or what, but the candles they had that they put in the eternal flame, they had to have somebody every week come in and light it on Saturday night. And it would burn from Saturday night until sometime on Thursday afternoon. But see, if you put a new one in on Thursday afternoon, then you never knew when it would go out. It would go out at different times and it would get all off. So what they did was they just let the eternal light go out every Thursday afternoon. Which, again, it kind of defeats the purpose of the symbol a little bit, don't you think? Going back even further, we're really on a tangent here, but this eternal flame, it really comes out of Roman Catholicism in the Middle Ages. When it was proposed that in order to mark the presence of Jesus always existing in the tabernacle or the box on the altar, this is saying after the priest consecrates the bread and wine and Jesus is present according to his words in the Lord's Supper, and then Rome retains some and they keep it on the altar, and you can go in and have devotion to it, you can worship and pray toward it, all this kind of stuff. In order to symbolize that, we're going to put this light here to show that Jesus is right there on the altar. Now, here's the thing. I mean, you want to talk about something that's too Catholic. Can you reinterpret this to mean is the light of God's presence? Yes. But isn't it interesting that we don't do that with the symbol from the Bible, which is the seven-sticked candle or lamp, which you do still see often in many Lutheran churches, although it's 14. You got two of them, one on either side of the altar. And fine, that's good. At least there we're showing, look, we light these things to show the presence of God. Although we light them even when we don't have the supper, we always light the two on the altar during the supper. Isn't it interesting how different our understanding is compared to what the Bible has? But nonetheless, I'm not trying to like bash it, right? I'm trying to challenge us to think about it. That's all. So you have the seven-sticked candle or lamp in this holy place, not the most holy, but the holy place of the temple, to show that God is with them with this covenant to bring light into darkness, to bring mankind out of death. And then he had a table on which they had what normally is translated as the shoe bread, right? S-H-E-U, but pronounced show and bread, which is, I'm not even sure why we do it like that, but literally it means the bread of the face, or sometimes it's called the bread of the presence, which is in some ways a very real symbolic presence of God Almighty himself. which was then eaten by the priests to keep them and make them holy. Now, can you, just, you see the foreshadow in that? There's a lot of foreshadow in that one right there. But that was there, this constant meal. It's placed new every week there, and the priests would eat it. And then outside of that, you had the burning altar, on which the blood of the sacrifices were always being thrown. And every single day, there was smoke rising as offerings were charred to pieces. They were burnt entirely. And then on festive days, it was even more, right? So when you had all the sacrifices of the big celebrations, tabernacles, and Passover and all that, it would be like all day long, you're just burning stuff. I mean, it had to smell awful, honestly. It had to smell terrible. It had to be as gruesome and disgusting as a crucified man hanging on a cross. Which is kind of the point. But before anything else, you got to understand, to be a Jew, historically speaking, today it's not true. This is not true quite. It is for some, but not quite for most. To be a Jew meant to place all of the identity of your past as a people and as a person and as a heritage and the hope of your future in this building, in this box, in this priesthood and covenant and promise and presence. So what do you do when that gets destroyed? What do you do even after it's rebuilt when you don't live there anymore? What do you do when, after it's rebuilt, you do live there, but the guy who's sitting on the throne claiming to be the king is not a son of Israel, not a son of Jacob, but a son of Edom, that is a son of Esau? What do you do when the Ark of the Covenant never came back? And this is where their history is so important. What do? When you're worried about the future, when you're not sure what's going to come next? What do when you can't see through the cloud of this present darkness toward the light of dawn of which you've been promised is going to come? Well, if you're a faithful Hebrew of old, like a faithful Christian of the day, you stop trying to look forward through the gloom and you remember. You remember that Abraham was promised all these things, and yet the children of Abraham lived as slaves in a foreign land down in Egypt, making bricks out of clay and straw, and then just clay without straw, that they were tormented, that they had no land of their own, let alone the freedom to go there. And yet, by a mighty hand, and with great deliverance, God had said, look, I know this, guys. I know what's going on. I promise this. I've even heard your cries. I will bring you out. And then he did. You remember Egypt, and you remember the Exodus. You remember the darkness, and you remember the light God brought to pass. Then you remember, we've talked about this before, right? There's two. There are two major paradigms for the history of Israel's hope. Egypt and by the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down and wept as we remembered Jerusalem. And on the willow trees there by the waters, we hung up our stringed instruments and refused to sing, even though our captors demanded of us a song, saying, sing to us one of those happy songs of Zion, in mockery. But how? How shall we ever sing the Lord God Almighty's song when we yet dwell in a foreign land? That's, well, my paraphrase of some of Psalm 137, one of my absolute favorite psalms. It's just beautiful. And that probably has to do with my time a little too close to Rastafarianism. But you hear in it, right, this idea that what are we without Jerusalem? We're nothing. We have nothing. And yet, there, at that place, at that time, underneath the greatest kingdom that ever would be, at least so far as the golden head of Nebuchadnezzar's statue confesses, is prophesied, Yet this people, their history, their religion, their covenant, and their promise, it outlasts that magnificent kingdom. Even as that kingdom is broken, its feet shattering and all around it collapsing to the dust, they are rebuilding that temple in Jerusalem. They are standing firm, trusting that the promises will bring darkness into light. And we've talked recently about Antiochus Epiphanes IV, that horrible Seleucid emperor who seeks in a very, very, probably after Hitler, or really maybe more than Hitler, the most in the history of mankind, a guy who really just intended to murder all the Jews, to get rid of them entirely, one way or the other, to breed them out of their religion, at the very least, into his common people. It wasn't racially motivated quite the way Hitler was, but it was religiously motivated in the way that Hitler was. With all the power of Syria, right? One of the great empires of the world at the time. Yet, a band of loose-leaf rebels, under a guy named the Hammer of God, casts off that Syrian power. Takes the temple, which had been desecrated by pagan sacrifices, and with palm branches in their hands, celebrates the Feast of Atonement, the purification. In every hour of dark history that the Hebrew peoples had faced, the deepest, blackest night through which they could not see, always was broken by a dawn of morning that was bright. And while somewhat unexpectable, nonetheless expected by those who sought their hope, not by looking forward, but by looking back, by remembering that the prophecies always to bid them wait, wait, because the Lord would rise and act. And since David's time, since Solomon's time, all the way through this Babylonian and Maccabean edge, that waiting was for the coming of the Messiah, the anointed one, the heir to David's throne. Who would do what? He would reign in Jerusalem. This is the most important thing to understand the mindset of the people who did live in that Palestinian area at the turn of A.D. Even though, and this is connected, even though a vast, vast number of the Hebrew, the Jews, didn't actually live there anymore. They lived in this thing called the dispersion, scattered by the judgment of God, according to his own threats in Deuteronomy 30 and Isaiah 49, scattered to the edges of the earth, kicked out of, vomited out of their land. Now, again, God had brought them back, Nehemiah and Ezra's work, Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest, but not all had come back. And yet, even dispersed as they were, living in a vast number of places, we'll talk about that a little bit here, they could not be Jew without turning their eyes toward Jerusalem. And that's sort of what we want to start to think about a little bit here, because the first century world of Jesus, the Judaism which it engaged, was not just the Judaism of the Pharisees. It was influenced, impacted by the Judaism of the world too. And this is a bit that, you know, you just don't quite hear about it as much in the Bible, but you do. You get it in Acts, and you get it a bit in 1 Peter, where they engage the fact that the Jews are living in every country under heaven. Josephus tells us this. He tells us no nation in the world which had not among them part of the Jewish people existed. And another Greek geographer and historian named Strabo, he says this. He says, it is not easy to find a place in the world that has not admitted this race, right, let them in, and is not mastered by it. Now, there's a lot of anti-Semitism that exists today based on that kind of thinking, and please don't hear me saying that that is how I think or feel, but I think it's important to recognize that the Jewish people in the ancient world, they were power brokers. They're players. hey, man, I want to be a player. I'm not looking down on them. So don't hear me saying this is bad. It is, they had really, and today you can say the same thing, part of because of their cultural strength. I admire this. I wish we Lutherans had even a whit of such care for our own culture and our own unity as a people. But they, in the ancient world, they were power brokers. Which was doubly interesting. Can you imagine this? So you live as a foreign people, an outsider, in a land that is mostly made up of an ethnic group that is different than yours. You're a minority, but you have money. You have control of merchant stuff, ships. So you're part of a trading clan, as it were. But you also have a religion that's different because you have to look toward a different place, a different city, which is not your own. So there's a certain loneliness and an ostracization, which was not just only enforced by persecution or racism. Certainly those things were there. But it's self-imposed, not as a bad thing, but as part of your very spiritual identity. That you're the holy people. Now, again, I'd like to think that Christians should think this way a little bit more. Not that we would look down our nose at those around us, but that we would recognize that we are, wherever we go, a people set apart. Because like the Jews of old had but one true city, no matter where they lived, Alexandria, Antioch, or Rome, didn't matter. They had one city, and that city with foundations was Jerusalem. So also, we have but one home. Citizens of a better kingdom. And get me here, I'm not talking about heaven. I'm talking about the body and blood of Christ given for you to eat and drink in the bread and wine. It's a potent thought. There is no common union. There is no fellow state. There is no familial sharing of bloodline than the cup of the New Testament by which the crimson atonement of Jesus of Nazareth, son of David, is poured down your throat. Now, kind of the main thing then to know about this dispersion, this flinging of the Jews to the nations, we're not talking about the lost tribes of Israel here. We're not talking about the 10 tribes scattered by Assyria. That they're actually, well, we probably won't have time to get there today, but they're lost. We don't know where they are or what happened to them. There's some mythology about it. They're by this sacred river that stops its flowing on every Sabbath, stuff like that. Right? You can't put any trust in any of that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about just the dispersion of Judea, the Jews, Judah, Benjamin, and the Levites, right, that happened under Babylon, and how after that event, they ended up all over the world, not just in Babylon. And you can divide this scattering into two different spheres, two different groups. What we have to call, because it's the way they called it, the West and the East. Now, don't get caught up in your map too much, because the West is often going to be the North. but it also is going to be West. And then you have the East. And part of this is understanding how these two distinguishing groups, Western dispersed Jews and Eastern dispersed Jews, didn't like each other. They were divided in a number of ways and really thought differently of each other and were treated differently by the powers that be in Jerusalem itself. Before we talk about that, what I want to show you, because I think this is just pretty cool, is you actually see this distinction, this division amongst the Jews, amongst themselves, in which they hated each other for cultural and spiritual reasons. You see this bound together, unified and undone, in Peter's preaching on Pentecost in a very, very clear way, if you have the history. Now, this is a passage that goes by very quickly when you hear it read. And usually the emphasis is on the speaking in tongues that is taking place. There is this huge crowd of people in Jerusalem who are all Jews who are there for the Feast of Pentecost, otherwise known as the Feast of Weeks. And the emphasis is on, look at all these different people and how different they are because they have all these different names. But the thing is, as different as they are, they very clearly fit into two categories. So if you happen to have a Bible near you, I mean, pause what I'm talking about right now and just go find Acts chapter 2, verse, I guess it's about 8 and following. And I want you just to skim through there. I want you to find the word in the middle. The word in the middle is Judea. Now, it's funny that he would even mention people from Judea, because where are they? They're in Judea. That's where they're standing. That's where all this is happening. They're in Jerusalem. It's in Judea. But if you go left of Judea in the text, you end up going right on a map. You end up going east, where the Parthians and the Medes and the Elamites and the residents of Mesopotamia are. Parthians, these are the descendants of the Persians, more or less. They kind of build the post-Persian empire. It's never really conquered by Rome. Alexander breaks Persia, but then it all scatters and breaks up, and the Parthians kind of get their stuff back. The Medes as well were connected to them. And the Elamites were from southern Iran, right? Like ex-Babylon. And Mesopotamia is Babylon. It's the location of the Tigris and the Euphrates River. So while they're listening, are we not all these various groups, those from Babylon and its tributaries on one side of the Judea to the east? And then to the west, to the right in the text, to the left on the map, Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia. Asia is the key there. This is not, you know, China. This is Asia Minor, and all of these names here are actually parts of Asia Minor. Today we would call it Turkey, and leading up toward the Greek areas as well. Phrygia, Pamphylia, all of that is Asia Minor, different parts of what today is Turkey. And then with that, Egypt, clearly to the west. Libya and its capital Cyrene on the north coast of Africa, clearly to the west. And then, not necessarily the farthest away, but kind of the farthest away intellectually, Rome. And then the description which Luke gives us, it shifts into these parallels, right? So both Jews and proselytes, that is, those who are descended by blood from Judah and those who are following our history and religion, not because they are by blood, but because they have believed their way into it. Jews and proselytes, that's a parallel. And then another parallel, Cretans and Arabians. Now, you got to hear this as well. So where's Crete? It's in the middle of the Mediterranean world, in the middle of the west, yeah, a big island, west of Judea, kind of centered on all of this Greek-speaking, Hellenized region he's just been talking about. And then Arabia, where's that? It's all the way the other direction. It's the farthest flung, most kind of outlying place of the east. So Jew and Gentile, west and east. Telling in our own tongues the mighty works of God. Okay, so why is this important? Because between the Western and the Eastern Jew, in these categories, there was a great divide of thought and understanding and belief and even, yes, racism. To the level that if you were a Jew from the West, say from Alexandria in Egypt, where you would be speaking Greek as your mother tongue, well, then you were called a Hellenist, a Greek, by the Palestinian Jews. And if you were a Jew living in Babylon, in one of the treasure cities where the merchants, the Hebrew merchants of the world, were busy funneling money back to Jerusalem, well, then you were called a Hebrew. Right? So you're a Jew, but you're a Greek, and you're a Jew, yeah, you're a Hebrew. And it had everything to do with where you lived and the culture that was around you. Now, remember, it's not all like this is all just wrong-headed evil. They're trying to protect their history. They want to stop what I can only call worldview leak, where you forget who you are because the world around you is so strong that it pushes its way into your mind and heart and soul and pushes out your identity, your history, and your hope. Again, something we should be more than well aware of these days in the United States, that the dominant thinking, the dominant spiriting, that just being pummeled at us day in and day out through endless streams of media, it wants to push its way into our minds and our hearts and push out, cause us to leak out what the Word of God actually says, our identity in Christ, our trust in the supper. And this was a fear for them as well. But they believed that the Greek leak was more dangerous than the Babylonian leak. And there's actually kind of a really interesting little reason for this as well. It might just be an excuse. I mean, yes, the money was in the East. That's a big thing right there, right? You had these merchant treasure cities, but where they were literally funneling funds from the entire known world. I mean, some of the later Jewish writings, they tell us that the caravans carried rich carpets and woven goods from the Far East, as well as precious spices, all the way to the West. And that these goods were pushed through Palestine, through Jerusalem, where there was a healthy bit dropped off in terms of finances, to the Phoenician harbors on the kind of, we'd call it, I guess, the northern or the northwestern coast of the land, where it would be sent west toward Rome. So that the Hebrews who dwelt in the Babylonian area, they were merchant princes, bankers, and shippers. So if you're in Jerusalem, and in one sense, that matters. That's where the money is. But that's not all that it was. It's not the only thing that it was. There's another piece to this. There's a bit of history from the Bible in which we learn that David's kingdom extended all the way east to the banks of the Tigris River, which is the further river, which means that at least some element of what really could be considered Babylon as a country, so far as we can call it a country, that land was at one point part of David's Israel and Solomon's Israel. And this led the Palestinian Hebrews, returning from the diaspora, from that place, right, where they left behind much of their wealth and much of their knowledge and much of their culture, it caused them to consider that place part of Israel. They would actually talk about this, that it was part of the land. So that if you were a Hebrew, right, living in the wealthy suburbs of Babylon, sending money to Jerusalem, you could spiritually tell yourself, I'm living on the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm in the kingdom of David, on the place, the land, the holy land. Whereas if you were living in Egypt, not so much. No such thing. And I mean, get this. The Pharisees are ones who really, really held to this view. And here's how they would even explain it. This is an interpretation of Isaiah 43:6. I'm going to read the text to you first. Isaiah is prophesying the return of the people of Israel from their exile. He says this, I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. I will bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Okay? It sounds like, you know, I'm going to bring everybody back to Jerusalem, right? I'm going to bring you all back to the covenant. It's well and good. But see, here's the interpretation from a Pharisaic Hebrew source. That by my sons from afar, it is meant these are the exiles in Babylon whose minds were as settled as men. And by my daughters from the ends of the earth, these are the exiles in the other lands whose minds were as unsettled as women. I mean, I talk racism, a little sexism there, right? Did you follow this? So the text says, God says, I'm going to bring my sons back, I'm going to bring my daughters back. And the Pharisee says, yes, sons, the Hebrews in Babylon, who we all know are well thought of, they speak the holy language, all yada, yada, yada. And therefore God describes them as men, because men are better. So he says, so they think. And then my daughters, you know, a bunch of wily women who learned the Greek language and live in Alexandria now. And yeah, they're fine. They're part of us. They're part of our bloodline. But you know, they're about as a quality as a woman would be. And you got to let. I mean, there you do have some serious sexism there. Yeah, seriously. And their reasoning for maintaining this is twofold, right? One is, again, this belief that they're actually on the Holy Land still. And we're going to get that land back eventually when the Messiah comes. And the other one being that this worldview leak of the Eastern territories, because it's not Greek, will not have as much of an influence and affect an impact on our history and our hope. And this is one of the things that leads into the real racism that will come about and is part of the culture around Jesus, where the Judeans despise, say, the Samaritans. Is because the group from Babylon that returns and sends and repopulates Jerusalem, right? They're not coming back from the other areas. They're coming back from Babylon. It's not all the people from Babylon, but they're from Babylon. In order to preserve the priesthood, that is, that there will be a lineage of Aaron dealing with the sacrifices that the temple is being rebuilt, they spend a lot of time focused on lineage and genealogy. And this is somewhat connected to Ezra, who biblically was a pretty important guy, but there's a tradition around him that ends up being, well, maybe the wrong direction. But Ezra, you might remember this, maybe. We don't spend a lot of time in these chapters. Ezra 9 and 10, Ezra settling back in the land, there's a lot of emphasis on not intermarrying with foreign groups to preserve the lineage, to preserve the bloodline of the Hebrew people. And again, this is somewhat connected to, they did need to preserve the bloodline of two things. Think about it this way, right? That the priests have to be from Aaron's bloodline. And guess who has to be from David's bloodline and Judah's bloodline? Yeah, the son of David, the Messiah. So there was a concern about maintaining this. And there certainly is stuff in the Old Testament too about, you know, Solomon marries foreign wives who practice foreign religions and it doesn't go so well for his faith. So there's some good reason for thinking this way, but it really leads not into preserving the faith as into believing in a, can we go Harry Potter now, pure blood view of Judaism, where they kept records of this. Records that were so intense and so focused that Herod, right, that guy, the Idumean pretender king, he actually seizes them and burns them to try to get rid of them. Why? Because they're proof he's not a son of David. But see, so who has these pure blood records? Well, that's the Eastern Jews, not the Western Jews. If you're a Jew in Alexandria in Egypt, translating the Bible into Greek, you pagan, well, you don't have this kind of pure record. And as a result of this, then, it is the mind of the East that really becomes the dominant influence of the thinking as to what Judaism is. There are rabbinic schools in Alexandria and in the West, but they do not have the influence, nowhere near the influence that those of the East do. So some of the most famous names in rabbinic thought were Hillel the Babylonian and Eleazar the Mede, who are guys that are contemporaries of, living right up into AD. In fact, Hillel, he dies in AD 10. So his teaching, his rabbinic thought, his being kind of a masterful bringer of the law and attention to the law is a life's work that hits directly from Babylon into the Pharisaic mindset in first century Judea. The synagogue comes out of the Babylonian exile, where, so it was said, the first one was established by Jeconiah, king of Judah. Now, do you remember this guy? His father, Jehoiakim, is evil, does what is evil in the sight of the Lord, more or less gets conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, but then is made into a vassal king, and for 3 years he does that, and then he rebels, and then Nebuchadnezzar comes and is going to overthrow the city, and the people actually throw Jehoiakim's body over the wall. Like, Nebuchadnezzar, please go away. We don't want this guy. We want you. And for 100 days, the son, who's only 18 years old, Jeconiah, he rules, but Nebuchadnezzar does take the city, more or less, and then captures Jeconiah and takes him back. And for 37 years, he lives in Jerusalem with some of the cream of the crop of the nobility, guys like Daniel, right, who go, this is before the destruction. This is the kind of the first edge of the captivity. They go back to Babylon, and it's Zedekiah, the uncle and or brother of Jeconiah, who sits on the throne and is the last king, because he rebels again as well, and then it's all just wiped out. But Jeconiah, after the wiping out, here, this is tradition, right? This may not be true, but it's kind of a cool thing. It is said that Jeconiah, who was given preferential treatment, he kind of won the respect of the Babylonian king, both Nebuchadnezzar and then his son, Evil Merodach, which doesn't mean evil. It's really Amul Marduk. He wins a seat at their table. He feasts with them. He has good treatment. And so after the temple's torn down, he goes back, or he sends back, and he gets stones from the temple, and he uses it to build the first synagogue there in Babylon. And the idea that we have this place of meeting for the word of God that we endure with throughout the exile, waiting for the future hope, that spreads back to Israel, even within and under the return. So when the temple's being rebuilt, they're building these synagogues, this other form of tradition, all influenced by the teaching out of the synagogues in Babylon. where the wealthiest and most influential remain behind running their merchant businesses throughout all the various empires of the world. Now, within this influence of the synagogue come a number of things, which today are written down in such ways as kind of the only way we know about Judaism. And some of these are traditions that existed before and through the life of Jesus, but then only get finally written down after Jesus. But there's some words you should know, things you should know. Yeah. So one of the first things that happens is that in the reading of the scriptures in the synagogue, there needs to be a methargumen, or an interpreter. And this was on several levels. He was employed not only to explain the scriptures, but he actually had to retranslate them on the fly into the common language. Because one of the other things that's happening during this time is Hebrew is no longer being Hebrew. Hebrew is becoming Aramaic. It's, you know, English has the same problem. It changes over time. Well, so Aramaic develops and it's part of the connection, the worldview leak with these other sections of the world around them. So the average Jew living in Babylon spoke Aramaic, came into church and heard something beyond old James, beyond King James English. I needed somebody who was trained to translate it. Now, they didn't actually translate the scriptures because that would have been kind of blasphemous the way they saw it. Now, notice on the Greek side, they put it right into Greek. Septuagint, they have no problem translating it. But on the Babylonian side, no, we're gonna hold this distinction way back. But then you have then developing a tradition of a interpreter. And this is the origin of the thing that is called today the Targum, or the Targumim, which are a collection of paraphrases of the scriptures that initially were forbidden to be written down and had to be done on the fly, but over time, they gradually get written down. And today, hold quite a bit of authority. Now, that authority isn't really officially sanctioned until like the 2nd century AD. And just for fun, we'll name drop. It's connected to two guys, Onkelos, whose paraphrase of the Pentateuch is with us today, and Jonathan, the son of Uzziel, who has a paraphrase of the prophets. Now, while it is important to know that this is well after Jesus, those actual documents, the tradition which started those documents is an outcome of the schools in Babylon. And then you have the fact that after going back to the land, they don't have the Ark of the Covenant. They don't have everything that they need to observe the law. And so they begin, well, reinterpreting it. And so you get this other document that is at least initially being developed as a tradition. It isn't written down yet, but as a tradition that develops is called the Mishnah, which means, like Deuteronomy, it means second law. And it's more like a dogmatics for Judaism, for synagogal Judaism, coming again out of Babylon. And in this tradition, things that are not written down specifically, but were ways of thinking, you have two ways of thinking that kind of drive what Hebrew thought was. They're called the Halakna and the Haggadah. The Halakna, the to-go or the way, was the spirituality of being Hebrew. At least officially. It was the doctrine. It was the thing that didn't change. It was the thing that everyone had to teach and believe. But then you have the Haggadah, the to tell, which was a little bit more like sort of the wisdom or the understanding of individual preachers. And by the way, they called the preachers at the time Darshan. And the speaking of the Darshan, or the rabbis eventually, right, it had no official authority, but it had a huge popular influence and a great deal of doctrinal license as well. Kind of like, now forgive me, Lutherans do this too, but you really see this in Eastern Orthodoxy where you have the liturgy that never changes, ever, even though it has, it never changes. And then you have whatever any various priest decides he wants to teach about this, that, or the other thing based on something he read somewhere, right? It's kind of like that. And so the interplay between these two things, kind of forming the identity, the understanding of the people who are back now living in Jerusalem, it all comes from and is being fed by, as it were, a tributary out of these Babylonian rabbinical schools. So that those living right around the time of Jesus would have to acknowledge this. This is a quote now. It's from a little later, more like the 2nd century, but it would have had to be the way that the Pharisees and the way that the Sanhedrin understood things. that even though they thought living in Judea was where the real purity was, when the law had fallen into oblivion, it was restored by Ezra of Babylon. When it was forgotten a second time, Hillel the Babylonian came and recovered it. And when it a third time yet fell into oblivion, Rabbi Chia came from Babylon and gave it back once more. And that letter, Rabbi Chia, would have been from after Jesus' time. So, what are you to take from this? I mean, we're really only looking at the east right now. We'll look at the west next time. But take from this that even though they have repopulated the land, even though the temple's been rebuilt, even though the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they're all really important, the mindset of what it means to be a Jew at this time period, at the AD time, the beginning of Jesus' life, is so much bigger than that little tiny microcosm, that little bit of land. That land's at the center. The temple's at the center. They're all looking there. They all got to go there. That's what's happening at Pentecost. But they are far flung. They're living in Armenia and the Caucasus, all the way to the shore of the Black Sea and also the Caspian Sea and down along the Persian Gulf and even as far as India. And all the world and its influence is flowing to these, again, treasure cities, these merchant cities between the Tigris and the Euphrates River, the suburban wealthy elite who never went back to the land. They sent the poor back to the land. They stayed in Babylon and continued making money. It's all flowing through them and through the theological schools they've developed back to Jerusalem in route and trade. And as synagogue tradition, having a massive influence on what's going on there. To the level that in a rubric, which is an explanation of how to do things for the Day of Atonement that's found in the Mishnah, which again is written down later, but this stuff was kind of already there. It's happening, right? It's noted that the high priest wore, between the evenings on the Day of Atonement, a costly Indian robe. Why is that important? In the great effort to retain their purity. The worldview leak is strong. And this may or may not be a direct thing to take from this, but it is interesting. It's very interesting. The Saul of Tarsus, after he's converted, he tells us in a bit of an enigmatic bit that he spends 3 years in Arabia. That's in the east. That's toward Babylon. And we don't know anything about that journey, and we certainly don't hear about any conversions. You want to think, was Paul silent the whole time? But it's not until he comes back and goes west into the Greek lands that we have these massive conversions. That has something to say about both the influence of the Hebrew on the culture to the east and the influence of the Greek culture on the Hebrew to the west. Peter also, who writes 1 Peter from Babylon, he at the start of the book, he mentions to all who are in the dispersion, a clear reference to Babylon, and then he closes the letter, "She who is in Babylon greets you." That is, whatever little church I, St. Peter, the great apostle, am preaching in now, we greet you from Babylon. And how do I say that it's a little church? Well, there certainly would have been some converts. There's a boast from a Hebrew named Nahardaah that until the end of the 3rd century, no Jew in Babylon had converted to Christianity. Now, it may or may not be true, but it was not a big win. Let's say it that way. I want to close with giving you one other little piece. I mean, I mentioned the lost tribes earlier and how we don't really know where they are, but out of this Babylonian school of thought came a very, very important piece to why nobody understood Jesus when he would talk about the crucifixion of the Son of David and the Son of Man. And it was that in the Babylonian schools, it wasn't like they weren't reading the Bible. They were. And they recognized something really weird. They recognized not only was the Son of David going to come and conquer, but he was going to come and he was going to suffer. And they couldn't quite figure out how that was supposed to fit together. And they also remembered that the 10 tribes had been scattered to the 4 winds and dispersed among the nations never to come again. But they had sort of a mythology of these various places where they might have settled down, which even though all these names are kind of made up, some of them are at least, you know, it's a way of they say we don't know where they are, but we believe that they're somewhere. And out of these other tribes, it was believed that there would be another, a second Messiah. There would be the anointed one that would come from David to sit on David's throne in power and glory and might. And then there would come the son of Joseph, the Messiah from the tribe of Joseph. And his mission, his work would be to restore and bring back all the lost 10 tribes to submit to the Son of David after he had already conquered. And he would do this through some form of suffering as the suffering servant. Now, how much of this is connected to an attempt to reject the fulfillment of what Jesus did, and how much of this influenced people not understanding what Jesus was there to do? That's lost in the annals of oral tradition. And while certainly it's maintained to this day amongst rabbinic thinking that you have to have these two different messiahs, because otherwise you end up with a Christian understanding of the Messiah, that the Son of David dies, without question, that divide already existed, a result of the teaching of the rabbis out of the synagogues of Babylon, influencing the life and mind of the holy ones, the Pharisees, living in Israel, into which Jesus of Nazareth walked, carrying the full prophecy sometime around 33 AD.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes. And check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.